Good afternoon. I'm Tom Lutz, sitting in today for Ian Masters, Background Briefing with Ian Masters, and actually today, Background Briefing without Ian Masters. I'm the editor of Los Angeles Review of Books and a professor at the University of California, Riverside. Ian is taking a few days off for the first time, as I understand it, for in many years. Is that right? So I'm acting as guest host, a kind of Joan Rivers to his Johnny Carson. I'll try not to work too blue, as they say, keep the bleeps to a minimum, although it will be difficult, as we'll be talking about some very dreadful situations. When Ian asked me to step in, I wanted to do a show about some places and issues that are not always and not often in the news. And I have three guests today. In the last part of the show, we'll be talking with Michael Dunham about the situation in Tibet and the Tibetan refugee camps in Nepal. Today is the Dalai Lama's birthday, and thus traditionally a day of celebration, a holy day among Tibetans. And those celebrations have been widely and in some cases brutally suppressed in both Tibet and Nepal. The Dalai Lama gave a major speech this morning in Washington, D.C. And Michael, who has spent a lot of time in the region and written about it extensively, will give us a report. Before Michael, however, we'll talk with Ben Ehrenreich, who has recently returned from the West Bank, where he was reporting on water issues for Harper's Magazine. We'll talk about those issues, but also about I guess it's almost too obvious to say it, the very complex political situation there. Since Ben was there, as the Arab Spring rippled across the region, he has some very interesting observations to share with us. And first, but not least, we have Adam Summers, who is executive director of Penn USA, and he'll be telling us a bit about Penn and its activities. And in the interest of full disclosure, I have myself been somewhat active in Penn for some years now. But we'll be talking primarily about Ethiopia, and because of Penn's mission, we'll be talking mostly about the problems journalists are and have been facing there. Today, a number of news services are reporting on what the Associated Press has called the Triangle of Hunger at the borders of Ethiopia, Somalia, and Kenya, where drought has killed thousands and where refugee camps now house almost 400,000 people. Closely related to those developments, 2 days ago, Ethiopian troops killed 15 soldiers of the Ogaden National Liberation Front and two Swedish journalists, freelance journalists, who were covering the ongoing war and were with the ONLF, were arrested by government forces. And as Adam will tell us shortly, they are far from the first journalists to be taken into custody. It's a practice that has become a kind of governmental reflex. I'm now joined by Adam Summers. Adam spent some 30 years in the music business, notably at Warner Brothers Records, at Neil Young's Vapor Records, and as head of new media at DreamWorks Records. But since 2004, he's had the much more interesting and important job as executive director of Penn Center USA, which I'll be calling, after common usage, Penn USA. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Summers.
Welcome, Tom.
Many listeners, I'm sure, are aware of Penn USA, but give us a quick description of the organization, and then I'll ask a few questions about Ethiopia and your organization's efforts, I guess our organization's efforts, on behalf of Ethiopian journalists.
Okay, there are 144 Penn centers around the world, and in particular, two in the United States. American Penn, which is housed in Manhattan and is probably more well-known than our center here on the West Coast, although next year will be the 70th anniversary of this center's operation, starting in Los Angeles in particular and then spreading out through the western states. And all Penn centers in the world, to a greater or lesser degree, are involved with two tracks of programming: freedom to write, which is what Penn centers are usually best known for, characterized as helping to get imprisoned writers, imprisoned for their writing, that is, out of jail or out from under persecution around the world. And then in America, defense of the First Amendment, anti-censorship, shield laws for journalists, things like that. So that's basically the other track I should mention is supporting the literary community. So there's readings. We have Penn in the Classroom, Emerging Voices, number of other programs that are involved in the literary side of it as opposed to the human rights side of it.
And the literary side of it in a not necessarily just literary salon and discussion, but in terms of and Penn in the Classroom and Emerging Voices are both programs for teaching writing.
Well, yes. I mean, the actually Penn in the Classroom and Emerging Voices, when we actually talk about them, we consider them to be under the heading of freedom to write, because in the case of the Penn in the Classroom program, which is a 12-week residency in high schools, the idea is for students who might not otherwise have the opportunity to identify that they have a voice, get a chance to explore that, and the residency ends with a published anthology and a public reading. So there's a whole empowering series of events that go down. And then Emerging Voices, I won't bore you with the whole history, but the idea is there were segments of the population in Los Angeles and other parts of the United States where various groups, whether it was gender-based or sexual orientation or the immigrant experience, were cut off from mainstream publishing. And so we've created this program now in its 15th year and diversified out to include men as well as women. It was originally a women-only program, so that there are people who can, you know, get a pathway to mainstream publishing, hopefully. And we have, over the past 15 years, you know, we've got like, you know, 3 or 4 dozen novels published, hundreds of articles, anthologized pieces. It's a very successful program. 115 people have gone through it, so it's relatively small. So we're very proud of the publishing record and, you know, think it's impressive vis-a-vis the size of the number of people that have gone through.
Yeah, fantastic. Let's in relation to Ethiopia, let's start back a few years. In 2002, Penn USA gave its annual Freedom to Write Award. It's an award that you've been giving for quite some time.
20 years.
20 years. You gave the Freedom to Write Award to a group called the Ethiopian Free Press Journalists Association.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about who they are and the events that transpired around that award.
Well, I if you don't mind, I'll back up just a little bit more than that.
Okay.
long before I arrived at this Penn Center, there was a gentleman named Larry Seams, who was in charge of Freedom to Write for this center, who is now the head of Freedom to Write at American Penn, and in my humble judgment, probably the best guy doing what we do in the world today, and somebody who I collaborate with all the time and who I have a great deal of respect for. And some of Larry's initial work had to do with helping to get Nigerian journalists who are under pressure out of the country and into safe haven and providing support and advocating through the Penn International Penn system on behalf of those writers' individuals' cases and imprisonments and persecutions. And then things sort of settled out there. There was also the Ken Sarawiwa issue, the work that was done by our center and International Penn and other centers around the world to go after Shell's, you know, I don't know what the word would be, but the spoiling of the Nigerian, the Ogoni tribe's lands, the brutalization of the countryside and the people in pursuit of oil. And then all that sort of settled down. The Nigerian, there was an election and a more democratic group of people came in and there was more press freedom and all that pressure was taken off. Then you, which brings you then, and we were also involved in establishing a Penn Center in Sierra Leone right after that civil war and helped rebuild some of the literary culture and freedom to write aspects there. And then in 1994, Elias Wandamu, who's on our board, was forced to leave Ethiopia for his political views and started being involved with Penn here and helped work on the Nigerian things. And then you come to the situation in the early part of 2000 where the Ethiopian Free Journalists Association, or Free Press Journalists, I call it a different name, start to feel the pressure. And so there's some advocacy that takes place. And because of the formation of that group and the work that they were doing to be a loyal opposition and write what they felt was the truth, they received this award. And Kifle Mulat, who was the president, came to America and accepted the Freedom to Write International Award at that time.
This is Tom Lutz. I'm sitting in for Ian Masters on Background Briefing. And I'm speaking with Adam Summers, executive director of Penn USA. And this last year, Ethiopia, we should say, for people who don't know, right, is run by Meles Zenawi, who's part of the force that overthrew Mengistu, who is one of the top 10 nasty dictators in the last 100 years, which is a tough club to get into. Zenawi has been being reelected by phony majorities for quite some time. And Mengistu is a guest of Robert Mugabe's, right? And so the problems with journalists being arrested are widespread, constant. And just this last year, PenUSA gave its Freedom to Write Award to another Ethiopian journalist.
Yes, Cisse Agena received the award last November. We were hoping that he would be able to travel to America and receive the award in person, but there were some complications with the visa, which we subsequently were able to overcome in January of this year. And he has traveled to America and is here, and we're hoping to put together a ceremony to give him, actually physically give him the award, and there's a stipend that goes with it that could be helpful. And also, kind of as a retrospective of our work in Ethiopia, we were hoping to bring in Kifle Mulat, who's now relocated to Houston, Texas, and another gentleman named Daniel Gazahenge. I'm killing his last name, but I apologize. But who is somebody we helped originally in Yemen, and then he emigrated in, he's in Atlanta, Georgia. And these are people who I hadn't really thought of it in this way, but Elias, who's on our board, and I were talking about this, and he pointed out that in the case of Daniel, who we helped in Yemen, who was suffering from some diabetic problems, that had we not helped him with the medical care, he would be blind now. And had he not emigrated to America, he'd be dead now, as would probably Kifle and Cisse. So we're just kind of like, it kind of shocked us when we were talking about it, that we actually have done some things that turned out to be, you know, crucial in certain people's lives. And so that's kind of where we've come to at this moment.
Yeah, and not just in Ethiopia, but in many countries around the world. It's right. PenUSA.org, we should say.
Yes, that's the website.
That's the website. And then very recently, I mentioned the two journalists that were arrested in the last couple of days. Hillary Clinton was just in town in Addis Ababa, right?
There's a confluence of events in Addis Ababa that is actually absolutely mind-bending. And I may mess up the chronology here, but it's within days or weeks of each other. And what you have happening is Hillary Clinton, you know, speaking in Addis Ababa and saying what a great guy the leader of the country is and what a good job they're doing. And you then in June 13th to 17th, there was a meeting of a working group to come up with a proposal for media freedom in South Africa to be presented at the African Union meeting that's coming up in September. And as these things are going on within days, the government is declaring under a terrorism act that they passed that a number of groups are terrorist groups and starts arresting all these people. And some of these, this one particular group called Ginbot 7 contains a lot of journalists and is really just the political opposition. And they just scoop them up and they're in jail. And so who knows what's going to happen to them. Over the last 10 years, 120 journalists have fled Ethiopia at risk of losing their lives.
The Ethiopian Free Press Association is that?
Yeah, Journalists Association.
Journalists Association was actually founded in Amsterdam or somewhere, right? Out of the country.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know that. I don't know that.
By people who had already fled the repression. Hillary Clinton's part in this is?
I guess it's more important to have someone to contain Somalia than it is to have freedom of press or freedom of speech. I mean, we may be overly simplistic, but for the Penn people, I think around the world, you know, freedom of expression trumps all, and it's the basis for how you have a free society and citizens operating in that way. So, you know, we understand the realities of geopolitical things, but, you know, the group that took over, the people that took over in 2005, if I have this correctly, you know, there was an election that put in a very democratic parliament, and as those people were seated, they just arrested all those people and seized power. I mean, it was looking like it was going to be a sunny spring, and then it's winter, and it's been that way ever since.
There was a great celebration after that election.
Exactly. And crushed. Yeah. So all these people are, I mean, the fact that these, I mean, Cisse, who we gave the award to, you know, spent, you know, a couple of stints in prison, 2, 3 years, 5 years at a time. And, you know, it's amazing that these writers hang in there and keep going up against this government that is just brutal in repressing them.
Now, I know that you can't talk too much about Cisse Agena and what's happening with him now, but He is. You helped him get out of the country.
We absolutely did.
And we're hoping that at some point he will be able to come forward and collect his award.
Yes, and I think I'm positive that's going to happen maybe in the next month or so. And when that does happen, we are going to have a celebration and an award ceremony in Little Ethiopia in one of the restaurants where we've done this before. And I'm probably going to bring Kifle and Danielle in from Houston and Atlanta and reunite this group and kind of marvel at the fact that this whole group of people has, you know, we've been able to help out.
In the long run, these journalists would, I assume, like to go back to Ethiopia and resume their jobs and do the work that they've spent their lives trying to do within this system.
Absolutely. I believe that all these Ethiopian writers, and in fact, maybe a huge part of the expatriate Ethiopian diaspora would like to return to Ethiopia if the conditions. I mean, we have done some events with the Ethiopians and we're surprised that the issues that are confronting, you know, generation 1.5, 2.0 and all that sort of thing in other cultures is a matter of assimilation or not assimilating or, you know. From what I gather from hearing them speak about it, is there's no assimilation. That they may have in fact assimilated, but the idea is that when conditions are right, they're all going to sell their homes, and you know whether that actually happens, I don't know. But that's the mindset: is that No, they're going back. You know,
and this is very much a Los Angeles story, right? I mean, there are the two main Ethiopian communities are
Washington D.C. and
Los Angeles.
Huge. I mean, just for Penn, just to give you a little anecdote, when I first became the executive director, an issue came up of an Ethiopian journalist who was in prison and being held for bond and that he could be bailed out. And one of the first things I ever did as kind of a cross-cultural event was take a certain amount of money, which was not a very large amount of money in terms of American terms, a few hundred dollars in cash, and our offices were in the mid-district by Lafayette Park Place, and walk across Wilshire by Ramparts to this Korean grocery and have this young Korean boy with a purple mohawk type in the Western Union and send the money to Otis. And then we send a, you know, keyword and a secret code or something like that. And this guy, you know, is popped out of jail. Mm. And it was hard to wrap your head around. Like, that's it? I go to the Western Union window, and there's this funny teenage kid there, and I push the money through, and he pushes out a receipt, and we send an email, and that's it. And he's out of jail on the other side of the world. And I think Elias's point on that when talking about it is that you just do them one at a time. Mm-hmm. You just do them as they come. What's put in front of your face, you do what you can, and hope it works out.
It's a wonderful program. I've always been very proud to be a small part of it, and you're doing a fantastic job at it. The stories are not always simple success stories, right? That is, these are in some cases people who are who have been tortured, have been beaten, have been when we manage to get them out, they're a bit of a mess, and it's not always just a happy story.
That is absolutely true. I mean, this, without mentioning a certain person, because I don't want to put him at any risk, but there's somebody who we, in all good faith, you know, helped bring into America. There were a number of other organizations, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, a number of other, and plus American Pen, we collaborated. And somebody arrived here, and we're all excited that they're here, but getting them here is really just the first step, and we're kind of learning to temper some of our enthusiasm and making better choices, because what they require when they get here is not always something that we are in a position, either professionally or financially, to provide them. And it has kind of tempered things a little bit. I mean, I think given the opportunity to help someone escape for their life, we would do it. But there's a lot more that we need to develop and have available for these people. And there's no question that a number of these people come out have been horribly tortured. I mean, we then help them get some kind of psychiatric help, and see an incredible improvement, and then they'll fall away from that therapy and you see them fall apart, and there's a kind of a cycle that develops. But, you know, I'm not a therapist and I'm not a caseworker. I've got this organization to run, but somewhere down the line, I'm hoping that we'll be able to put together a program that will be able to provide those facilities as an extension of merely helping them arrive in America.
Well, thank you so much, Adam. I've been speaking with Adam Summers, who's the executive director of Penn Center USA, an organization of playwrights, essayists, novelists, and other writers, which works to protect the rights of writers worldwide. In a moment, we'll continue with Ben Ehrenreich on developments in the West Bank and Michael Dunham on the dire straits of Tibetans in Tibet and Nepal today on the Dalai Lama's birthday. But I want to thank you again. I've been speaking with Adam Summers, Executive Director of Penn USA. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you, Tom, for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
We'll be back in a moment. وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فقدت حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق امنيتك رصد السيارة وهويتك وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فكرت حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق أمنيتك انسرقنا من أرضنا بلدنا انغلبنا عحالنا انقلبنا اقنعونا وتدربنا نحمي إسرائيل من حالنا صرنا ممسوكين عساكر وين ما كان بس اللي كل هاد لمين وين 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 الملايين وين الملايين اللي بدنا تحرر فلسطين. Welcome back. This is Background Briefing. I'm Tom Lutz, editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books, sitting in for Ian Masters. I'm now joined by journalist and novelist Ben Ehrenreich, who has just returned from the West Bank in Palestine. Ben Ehrenreich's reporting has taken him to such places as Afghanistan, Haiti, Cambodia, El Salvador, Mexico, and Riverside. He's written two novels, The Suitor and Ether, his new novel will be coming out this fall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Ehrenreich.
Thank you, Tom.
Very glad you could join us today. As I said, you've just returned from the West Bank, where you were working on a story about water resources, water issues. But your trip coincided with the Arab Spring, so let's begin there.
Yeah, I mean, I went there with a focus that's not quite narrow. I mean, I was looking at one issue, trying to look at the occupation through the lens of water, which is something we don't talk about a whole lot in this country, but it's an enormous issue for Palestinians. It's a large issue in Israel as well, but the lack of water has really suffered in the occupied territories incredibly disproportionately. But so it became a way to look at the occupation in general. But when I got there, there were other things going on that didn't have a whole lot to do with water, although the water is sort of relevant to, you know, you find a spring that's been stolen or a cistern that's been demolished at almost every village you go to. The first day that I was in Ramallah happened to be March 15th, which was the day of the big protests all around the West Bank, as well as in Gaza, to end the division between Hamas and Fatah, which have been split since the election in 2006. And, you know, the way of demanding democracy in Palestine it was a little different than in the rest of the Arab world, and it focused not on the individual rulers in Gaza and the West Bank, but on ending the division between them. And both parties, both Hamas and Fatah, I think, understood that movement as a threat to their own rule. And both in Gaza and the West Bank, did end up repressing those protests. That first night of protests in Ramallah, I saw seven people carried off in ambulances, beaten up by thugs in the crowd. Fatah was much smarter about sort of trying to co-opt the protests, whereas Hamas was in Gaza was considerably more aggressive in putting them down. But it was this very interesting moment and I think continues to be a really interesting moment, when the kind of post-Oslo status quo really doesn't feel tenable to anyone, or to very few people, and that the powers that have been put in place since Oslo are really seeming like one of the primary hindrances in getting rid of the occupation and fighting against against the Israeli occupation.
Well, that movement, those demonstrations that began on March 15th, how did they come about? What's the is that a seriously organized political movement? Is that a another Twitter revolution? How did, do you know what the origin of it was?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely falls into the. I think there are kind of a couple different sectors of it, but the organizers definitely fall into the same kind of demographic category as the sort of Facebook revolution. I mean, most of the organizers that I met were young. Most of them were educated. Most of them were English speaking. Most of them, you know, were quite technologically literate. And it was a, you know, we're not talking huge numbers. In Ramallah, you know, there were at most 200 people in Al-Manara Square, in the central square. But, you know, incredibly devoted. They got beaten up that first night, and they were there every night that I was there. You know, people would get out of the hospital and come right back to the square. People were sleeping in the square every night. And, you know, then we saw in June, in the Nakba protests, several hundred people from that same group more directly confronting Israeli forces. There was a big protest in Colombia, as well as the protests, I think we heard a lot more about the Palestinian refugees in Syria and Lebanon coming across the border, but there were also major protests which were heavily repressed by the Israeli security forces in Colombia, just outside of Ramallah, at the major checkpoint separating Ramallah from Jerusalem. But yeah, I mean, I think this has been a movement that's been building in Palestine since before these revolutionary movements took shape in Tunisia and in Egypt. But the way the organizers talked about it to me was they hadn't been planning to do something as soon as March 15th. But when things started taking off in Egypt, they kind of accelerated their own schedule, and knew that they had to kind of try to work with that momentum.
Right.
So they definitely feel some kinship to those other movements around the Middle East.
Okay, I should say this is Tom Lutz sitting in for Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with journalist and author Ben Ehrenreich, recently returned from the West Bank. You wrote a piece in the Los Angeles Times in 2009 that I'm sure made you a lot of new friends. called Zionism is the Problem. And in it, you wrote that Jewish Americans in the 1940s, 1950s, for some time saw a kind of racist strand in Zionism that was called by leaders of major Jewish organizations Hitlerian. Not only was it not considered anti-Semitic, but was part of the mainstream Jewish American position, and that's slowly changed. I'm wondering if this recent trip of yours had any impact on your thinking about that same issue?
Yeah, I think if anything, it deepened my feelings about it, my understanding of it. I think, I think also deepened my sense of the tragedy of it. You know, that until, you know, after the middle of the 20th century, Zionism was a fairly, was far from a mainstream intellectual movement among Jews around the world. You know, most Jews around the world, even today, are more likely to end up in, you know, New York City or its suburbs than to try to go, you know, to the Holy Land. And something happened, I think, really after the 67 war, that it became not only the predominant, like, intellectual strain in Judaism, it became kind of the only one, and to question it, to voice any criticism of the Israeli state, particularly to voice any criticism of Zionism, gets you labeled an anti-Semite, a self-hating Jew, whatever. And I think it's terrible for many, many reasons. But I think being there and seeing the massive militarization, both obviously in the occupied territories, but it's also very evident in Israel itself, and the, you know, to use a kind of perhaps too heavy metaphor, the kind of barbed wire wrapped around people's brains and souls, kind of really deepened my sense of how terrifically wrong this is. And, you know, I think the recent spate of really openly, extremely racist laws being introduced in the Knesset in the last couple of years, and the rise of what had been really extreme right-wing positions in Israel, which are now quite mainstream or fairly mainstream positions, you know, I think illustrates, you know, that it's ultimately impossible to have an ethnically based state in a, well, I think anywhere in the world, but particularly mm-hmm. In an ethnically diverse place such as the land which we now call Israel and Palestine, particularly when, you know, there are the kind of extreme militaristic power relations brought about by an occupation, that can only result in, you know, rising levels of militarization, paranoia, racism, et cetera.
Right. Now, what I find very interesting about the movement that you were describing is that it's about bringing Fatah and Hamas together. It's about breaking down that already militarized relationship as well, right? And how exactly does that movement have a name? Are they calling themselves something?
The only name I ever heard people call them, and they call themselves, was you know, like the Shabab, like the youth. The kids, the boys, the guys.
Okay.
Although actually, I don't mean to make it gender specific like that. The organizing group was, you know,
the youth.
Probably more women than men.
Okay.
But yeah, no. There's from what I could tell, that they're not. There's not even a particularly uniform ideology. I mean, some had leanings closer to, you know, Marxist groups like the PFLP. Some were very clearly, like, identified themselves as basically Western liberals. But all of them were, you know, staunchly against the occupation and saw the division between, you know, division of Palestinians as, you know, something getting in the way of ever organizing against that.
And your sense of the way this is being received, beyond the town square?
My sense was that there was a lot of support for them. You know, there were already some links being developed while I was there, between those young protesters, young and mainly urban protesters, because those protests were limited to the cities and larger towns of the West Bank and Gaza. But there were already some links forming between them and the much older and more established movement, which is called the Popular Resistance, or the Popular Struggle, which has been ongoing since about 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Involved nonviolent demonstrations in a number of West Bank villages, the most famous being Bilin, Nabi Saleh. In some of those villages, those protests have to do with the wall, which is cutting off huge sectors of their land. And others, like Nabi Saleh, had to do with the settlement nearby taking over a spring. And, you know, we don't, unless you look really hard for news from Palestine in this country, you're not going to read about these protests. But every single Friday, in at least three and sometimes five or more villages, there are protests which are fiercely repressed by the IDF. You know, tear gas, rubber bullets, sometimes live ammunition, and, you know, taking on kind of incredible losses. These tiny villages, you know, which have huge sectors of their population in jail. huge percentage of their population injured, you know, which essentially invite the IDF into their, you know, when they take to the streets in their villages, the only consequence is that the military comes in and covers everything with tear gas, and you know, kids get arrested, adults get arrested, people get injured, and you know, they're willing to accept these consequences, and are out there every single week. And this has been going on for years, and you know, we don't hear about it at all. But
yeah, I feel terrible. Actually, just that we didn't spend the entire hour, because I feel like we're just getting started. I did want to ask you quickly. It is true that we don't get enough of that kind of news almost anywhere, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show today on Ian Masters' background briefing. I did want to ask you finally about water, though. As you say, water is a significant issue everywhere, and I assume especially there now.
Yeah, it is, and it's an issue in people's, you know, it's now the middle of the summer, and which means that not only in rural parts of the West Bank, but even in larger cities like Bethlehem, people can count on having water just, you know, a couple days a week if they're lucky. Sometimes water is off for many days at a time. The water issue really varies significantly in different parts of the West Bank. It's probably at its worst in the southern Hebron Hills, which is in very south of the West Bank, probably the poorest and certainly the driest part of the West Bank, where not only are there, you know, significant, you know, natural hurdles to getting enough water, but there have been ongoing aggression by settlers and by the Israeli Defense Forces against Palestinian villages, which takes these really kind of awful forms, often going in and destroying cisterns, filling in cisterns with dirt. And cisterns are, you know, basically it's basically a hole in the ground.
Right.
That collects water during the rainy season, and in a good year will allow a family, you know, enough water to get through the first third of the summer. And so, you know, the consequences of not having that water are quite devastating. You know, but then on a more systematic level, you know, Palestinians are not allowed to, for the most part, and they're very complex bureaucratic background to all of this, but for the most part, Palestinians have not been allowed to drill into the aquifer beneath their own land, which Israel actually draws quite a bit of water from. So even in the kind of wetter parts of the West Bank, there are these, you know, extraordinary differences between the fields of settlers and the fields of Palestinians. I mean, you can kind of tell from, you know, hundreds of yards away which is a settler's field and which is a Palestinian field.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us today, Ben Ehrenreich. I'm realizing that I am not cut out to be a host of this kind of program. It is just way too depressing. I've been speaking with.
I don't have any happy stories.
I've been speaking with Ben Ehrenreich, and neither do any of my other guests. So, author of the novels *The Suitor* and the forthcoming *Ether*. He's recently returned from the West Bank in Palestine, and your piece will be coming out in Harper's sometime soon.
Sometime soon.
Yeah. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back in a moment. Thanks again, Ben Ehrenreich.
Thanks, Tom. شرطة تدافعوا عن الناس ليش تدفعوا بالناس ولا في ناس وناس في يهود والباقي كلاته حماس انت قلبي لابس ازرق يا هلس سوينا ما لحقتش تشوفنا عم بشت علينا ضوء سيرينا حطيت كلبشين عايدينا يا حكومة انت ملعونة بتسوي طريقنا ملعونة Mara serva na tuzel mi kirva shiyo, mara serva na tuzel mi hoka shiyo, mara serva turi zeli nam ke shiyo, mara serva mara serva mara serva romo zeli nam ke shiyo.
Welcome back. This is Background Briefing. I'm Tom Lutz, editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books, sitting in for Ian Masters. I'm now joined by Michael Dunham, who's an author, photographer, and artist. He's worked extensively with Tibetan masters, including Pema Wangyal of Dolpo, to learn traditional Tibetan iconography. His books include Samya, A Pilgrimage to the Birthplace of Tibetan Buddhism, Buddha's Warriors, the story of the CIA-backed Tibetan freedom fighters, the Chinese invasion, and the ultimate fall of Tibet, and The Divine Art of Tibet, The Murals of Samya, which has a foreword written by the Dalai Lama. As I said earlier, today is the Dalai Lama's birthday, and ironically for such a gentle-seeming man, there is no more divisive figure on the Tibetan scene. When I was there recently, mentioning him brought down deafening silence everywhere. Now, Michael, as with any foreign political or cultural situation, it's hard to tell what people know and what they don't. In the case of Tibet, many Americans know that there's such a man that's called the Dalai Lama. Many know that he's in exile. Many know that he's a spiritual leader. We see bumper stickers that say Free Tibet. Listeners to this show probably know a lot more than that. But for those don't, can you give us a brief history of the events leading up to the uprising of 2008, by which time there were some 20,000 Tibetan refugees already in Nepal? Is that right?
That's right. Refugees from Tibet began funneling into Nepal around 1960. This followed the Dalai Lama's escape in March of 1959. He ended up in India. Many of the Tibetans remained in Nepal because the remaining freedom fighters who had been resisting the Chinese PLA army had regrouped in Mustang, a northern district that borders Tibet in Nepal. And the Tibetan refugee communities that we see in Nepal today are mostly made up of the old freedom fighters and their offspring. Now we're in almost the fourth generation of refugees in Nepal.
How many refugees now?
Approximately 20,000.
Okay, at this time. And they're living in what kind of conditions?
There are several communities. Two that are most well-known are in and around Kathmandu, and less known but in worse conditions are in the tourist town of Pokhara, which is in western Nepal, right at the base of the Himalaya. The problem that they're experiencing and have for decades is that they really have no right except to be in Nepal. They don't have the right to own property. They don't have the right to own their own business. They don't have the right to register the births of their children or the marriages of their children. They have limited freedom of movement. They have absolutely no freedom to speak or demonstrate these days.
And you're in Nepal fairly frequently.
Yes.
I want to talk in a moment about the book that you've been working on most recently in the refugee camps there. But first, the situation in Nepal is complicated by the place of Maoists and the Nepalese government at this point.
That's right, and also the geography, because it's a tiny little country. It's one of the poorest in the world, and it's sandwiched in between the two Asian giants of China and India. And there is a tug of war between those two countries, and the Maoists have been most famously using what's called the China card against India. They characterize the Indian government as the foreign influence that has damned them for the last five decades. And they're very willing to kowtow to the folks in Beijing, more so than any other party in Nepal. And since the elections of 2008, to the surprise of the international community, the Maoists actually won the majority of popular vote. And so they are truly a party to be reckoned with in Nepal.
And in Tibet itself, now you haven't been able to go back to Tibet for some time. Is that right?
Not since my book Buddha's Warriors was published, which was in 2004.
Okay, so you just simply can't get a
I've
visa.
had people who I respect tell me not to go back in there because I would be arrested as a spy.
It's you know, as I mentioned, I was there last year, and the kind of sense of military occupation that's there is intense. I had a friend who's also been in and out of Tibet quite a bit, who likens it to being a Native American in the United States in 1908, when things are over. There's a kind of ghost dance cult feel to the people walking around in a somewhat depressed haze of followed by men, Chinese soldiers in riot gear.
And after seeing that, the question that I always ask myself is, what would Tibetans find if they were able to return to Tibet? Because there's been such a systematic elimination of the language. If you are a Tibetan parent, you have to make the choice whether your young child is going to start in a Tibetan-speaking school or a Chinese. And if you go for the Tibetan, that child has no opportunities to get into higher learning. So, you know, if you kill a language, you're basically killing the culture.
This is Background Briefing. I'm Tom Lutz. I'm sitting in for Ian Masters, and I'm speaking to artist and author Michael Dunham on the occasion of the Dalai Lama's birthday about Tibet and about Tibetan refugees in Nepal. Today was his birthday. There was some preparations for the birthday in Nepal.
There were preparations. Just like everywhere else in the world, people were excited to be able to celebrate his birthday. However, the plans in Nepal were foiled by security forces. And I think this can be attributed to the new home minister, also the deputy prime minister of Nepal currently. He's one of the Maoist leaders. His name is Krishna Bahadur Mahara. And he's, of any of the Maoist leaders, he is perhaps in closest contact with the Beijing authorities. He's doing everything he can to suppress any kind of free speech or demonstration by the Tibetan refugees in Nepal.
And one of the things that people here know is that the Dalai Lama seems to have kind of resigned as the political leader of the Tibetans, a position that he was holding in exile for some time. But he gave a speech in Washington this morning, which sounds to me like a political speech.
It's hard for him to address the situation without being political. He is the leader, indisputably, of all the Tibetan people, and he's not allowed to be in his own country. So it goes without saying that anything he would say, whether or not it's political, would be interpreted by the Chinese government as political. Mm-hmm. They've painted him as a demon. Splitist is their favorite word. And anyone who approves of the Dalai Lama is also a reactionary and a splitist.
Mm-hmm. And a splitist means that you're splitting the...
You're challenging the idea that China... that Tibet at one point was an independent country, which China denies.
Right. So it means separatist, I guess.
Right.
Or secessionist. The book that you're working on now, it's called Caught in Nepal, Tibetan Refugees, Photographing Tibetan Refugees. I'm interested in this book because of the stuff of it, what it is you're actually doing. It's a very interesting project in all sorts of ways. And also, of course, as the editor of a book review, I'm interested in the way you're going about publishing it. But first, tell us what the project's all about.
Well, the genesis was that each year when I go visit the Tibetan refugee camps, it occurs to me that Western tourists who come to Nepal often go to the holy sites, the famous stupas, the beautiful temples, and they see Tibetans doing circumambulations around the temples, et cetera. And they come away feeling that the Tibetans in Nepal have it pretty good. And the picture, if you actually visit the refugee camps, particularly the ones that are in the hinterlands, the picture is quite different. And so it occurred to me about 3 years ago, wouldn't it be great to have a visual picture of what these camps are like taken by the actual Tibetans. So 3 years ago, I dispensed 10 inexpensive digital cameras to refugees, and none of whom had any real experience with a camera, and just told them, shoot your daily life. What may be boring to you may be of great interest to the outside world, and it's a historic document that no one else has cared to document. They took it to heart. Some of them became actually really amazingly good photographers given the rudimentary equipment I gave them. And so it was my way of giving the Tibetans the opportunity to speak for themselves, except with cameras.
Mm. And were they downloading the photos then onto a drive?
Yeah, that was a bit of a problem getting those images back to me. That was more of a challenge, partly because they had little access to computers. Mm-hmm. But eventually we worked out systems, and yes, they were. I eventually accumulated thousands of photographs that were digitally stored on discs.
Yeah, and they are. I've seen some of them. They are just fantastic. Some professional quality photographs, but just a kind of there's a clear understanding of what it is that's worth making an image of. That shows up in picture after picture.
That's right. I'm just thinking of one photograph in particular of an elderly lady who's having her fingernails clipped by a young man. And a Westerner wouldn't have access to that kind of moment. So there's some real intimacy involved, as well as some eye-opening views of the conditions in which they live.
Now, I know about this project in part because you've sent it my way as editor at Los Angeles Free Books, and I've lined up a reviewer, and the reviewer said, "How can I review a book that doesn't exist yet? Because this this book, in fact, does not quite exist, does it?"
It exists in proofs, and I also made it a point to have this published in Nepal. And there was an accompanying text which I wrote about the history of the Tibetans and the Nepalis, which goes back 2,000 years. And the idea is that it will be published in Nepal in October. And I've created a launch on Kickstarter.com. People can donate to make that come true.
And so they go to Kickstarter and they look for
Michael Dunham, or they can just type in Tibet and my project will come up.
Well, it's a changing landscape of publishing, and you've figured out yet another twist on it. And I wish you all the best, of course. And I'm going to go on Kickstarter myself and make a donation.
Thanks.
Thanks for talking with us today, Michael Dunham. I've been speaking with Michael, who is an author, photographer, artist, his new book, Caught in Nepal, Tibetan Refugees, Photographing Tibetan Refugees. We hope it will be available very shortly. As I was getting ready to do the show today, I was finishing reading Peter Godwin's The Fear, which is a book about Zimbabwe, about the problems in Zimbabwe, the deep, deep problems in Zimbabwe. I was in Zimbabwe earlier this year, and just on the Victoria Falls edge of it, and had not enough of a historical sense while I was there. Godwin talks about the 2008 elections in which Robert Mugabe held onto power through grotesque and widespread intimidation, beatings, murder, burning down of houses, rape. Torture. It's a horrific tale of a political system gone horribly wrong in the interests of a tiny few people. As I was preparing for each of my three guests today, this kind of haunting book was in the back of my mind the entire time. I've been trying to get some of the images out of my head, but the connections, that is that Mengistu, the ruler of Ethiopia, is now a guest of Mugabe's, part of that kind of corrupt dictators club that Mugabe has running down there. Adam Summers is working all over the world to try to help the kind of journalists who are have been shut down pretty entirely in Zimbabwe, and one of whom is Peter Godwin, who comes in and out of Zimbabwe at the threat of his own life. And Michael Dunham, of course, is a journalist who has been cut out of Tibet, a country that he's devoted his life to understanding and working with. It was such a pleasure today to talk to Adam Summers, Ben Ehrenreich, Michael Dunham. All three were talking in different ways about some of the very same things, about the lack of very important rights of speech and assembly, about deprivation and conflict, and in some sense about the divide between the haves and the have-nots, not so much in terms of resources and money, although they often follow, but about power in the realm of power, the haves and have-nots in the realm of power. Adam Summers works very diligently to try to protect people who are on the outs with the powers in their own countries. Ben Ehrenreich was just on the West Bank looking at people trying to exercise their right of free speech and assembly in order to change the power relationships in that region of the world. And Michael Dunham is, in fact, intervening to try to, as well, to try to give people a power of free expression that they wouldn't otherwise have. It was as I talked to each of them, I realized I really should have had a separate show for each of them. We could easily have done an hour apiece. We don't hear enough news about any of these places around the world, and this little bit I hope was helpful. And I realized that now I've become in some tiny way a part of the solution, and then in a larger way a part of the problem by only spending 20 minutes on each of these very complex and very troubling issues. I want to thank my guests once again: Adam Summers, executive director of Penn USA; Ben Ehrenreich, author and journalist; Michael Dunham, author and artist. It was a pleasure to sit in for Ian Masters. This is Tom Lutz, the editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books. We're at lareviewofbooks.org and hope to see you there. I'd like to thank my producer, Spencer Downing, and Kim Nassatier. The theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact Ian at ianmasters.com. Tune in tomorrow for another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.